Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers, pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent. I'd like to thank you for your prayers and for your financial support. And that's how we keep Lutheran Radio UK on the air, and we're deeply grateful to you for that. Today we continue our discussion with Dr. Susan Bachman. She is professor of rhetoric at Concordia University in Irvine, California, also director of their overseas study abroad program here in Cambridge in conjunction with Westfield House, our house of theological studies. We're looking at faith and literature. Susan, welcome back.
Thank you. I am extremely happy to be back again. I love to think about literature, talk about literature, and maybe just talk.
Well, hopefully our discussions have stimulated some thoughts and ideas within folks' minds, and we're going to continue that discussion today. But as we were talking, we're looking at literature. How should a Christian approach literature through faith, either specifically religious literature or perhaps secular literature? How can we see Christ in that?
Well, I think we can see Christ in lots of ways. We see with eyes of faith in whatever we read, and we Christians find it hard to separate our faith from what we read. But I hope maybe with looking at some of the poems, we're going to talk today about we're going to travel or fly on a magic carpet up to Scotland, and we're going to be talking about some very famous poems written by Robert Burns today. But we're going to look through not just Burns' faith, but our own faith and what we bring to the reading of these extremely popular poems. So I'm hoping to touch people today who might be listening, either who already maybe even have these poems memorized and enjoy them, and literature is a part of their lives, but also maybe someone who says, I really don't know much about poetry, and especially in school, oh, I hated poetry or something. So I'm hoping to turn that around today and begin in a sort of naive fashion, assuming almost nothing. So we'll start from the beginning, but with some really great poetry from Scotland today.
People in the UK know about Robert Burns, big celebrations in January, where often his poetry is read and songs are sung. Can you tell us a little bit about Robert Burns?
Well, I can. Whenever you look at that wonderful, excellent source called Wikipedia on the computer, one of the first things you can see is the birth and death dates. And you notice very quickly with Robert Burns that he only lived to be 37 years old. It was a hard life. He was a wee lad in Scotland and died in 1797. He was born to a farmer. He was the oldest of seven children, and his father and mother were pious people. He learned most of his schooling at home. His father wrote a treatise on what we believe in our Christian faith, a little bit of a homespun kind of catechism, which is what we Lutherans would say. So Burns was raised a pious person and a Christian. And in the two poems that I hope to touch on today, the first people may recognize from Burns Nights, if they've had fun at some of those January parties, we're going to talk about To a Mouse. And then if we have enough time, we'll get a little bit, at least to a summary of To a Louse.
All right. Well, let's begin with To a Mouse. What would you like to tell us about that?
Well, first of all, Americans know To a Mouse because of its absolutely most famous line by John Steinbeck, who wrote a novel called Of Mice and Men, and that really summarizes this poem. It's a poem ostensibly or on the surface about a mouse whose house has been disturbed by a plow, but toward the end of the poem, Americans have picked up, and other people throughout the years since Burns's death, that this one line summarizes sort of the theme of it, which is, the best laid schemes of mice and men gang eft aglay. The best laid plans of people's lives, mice or men, often go awry. And so I don't think there's a person in the world who wouldn't be able to identify with that basic theme. So it's a welcoming theme. It's something, it's a bit sad, but it's something that welcomes everybody in from childhood, somebody who's accidentally had some favorite toy broken or something happened that was unfortunate. We all can relate. So that's what this poem at least is welcoming people in at first.
And that's very much a biblical view as well, because we know that God in his sovereignty, his plans are greater than ours.
Absolutely. So we have some Bible passages that we'll be connecting with and some specific ones. But maybe I should just begin by reading To a Mouse, which first of all, apologies to any Scottish people who are listening. That isn't my skill to speak in your dialect, your brogue, and I'll probably get it all wrong. I'm going to do the best I can with making just a few changes for those who speak English but haven't a clue what the Scottish words are. So I'm trying to keep the original Scottish rhythm that's called the Burns stanza that you'll sort of pick up. Several long lines and then two short lines, four long lines and two short lines with a distinctive rhythm to them and a rhyme scheme. But I'm changing a few of the words. So if you hear them and you say, well, that's not how I memorized it in school. First of all, my apologies, but I'm thinking of our broader audience. Well, I would recommend then to audiences also to go online and find a real Scottish person reading it and you'll get it better. But this is an American person reading a Scottish poem so that we can all dig into it together. So here we go, To a Mouse. Wee slinking, cowering, timorous beastie, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start away so hasty with bickering brattle. I would be loath to run and chase thee with murdering paddle. I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earthbound companion and fellow mortal. I down a whiles, but thou may thieve, what then, poor beastie? Thou must live. An odd ear in 24 sheaves is a small request. I'll get a blessing with the leavings and never miss it. Thy wee bit housey, too, in ruin. It's silly, may's the winds a-strewin', and nothing now too big to build a new one. Oh, foliage green, on bleak December's winds ensuin', both cold and keen. Thou saw the fields lay bared and waste, and weary winter comin' fast, and cozy here beneath the blast thou thought to dwell, till crash! The cruel coulter passed out through thy cell. Thy wee bit heap of leaves and stibble hast cost thee many a weary nibble, so thou's turned out for all the trouble, but house nor holding endure the winter's sleety dribble and hoarfrost's cold. But, Mousie, thou art not alone in proving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes of mice and men gang aft to glay, and leave us naught but grief and pain for promised joy. Still, thou art blessed compared with me, the present only toucheth thee, but, ugh, I backward cast my eye on prospects drear, and forward, though I canna see, I guess and fear. Now, that's a bit of a long poem, but the basic thing is he's been plowing, and he turned up the poor mousie's little hard-saved home underneath the ground that poor mouse thought he was going to spend the whole winter there, and the winter was filled with little leavings and things he had saved, and now it's just been all upset. And so the poet is saying, I commiserate with you. The world's full of really miserable things that happen to people. I think the things that people can hear, and you have to go back over poems several times, but the things people can pick up and hear, first of all, is the narrator, the person who's above and who's with his coulter, with his plow, has dug up this little house of the mouse in the ground, is a kindly voice, is a sympathetic voice, is an omniscient voice that looks down and said, ah, this is what you were doing. You were saving so hard. You thought you were going to spend the winter there, and now it's all upset. It's all miserable. And it happens to people that way. But toward the end of the poem, he ends up saying, but you know what? You've actually got it better than me, basically because you're only in the present. You're only in that part of your world that's a small thing, a microcosm. But those last lines, but I, from the top, looking from the top, and I think we see God in this, I backward cast my eye on prospects drear and forward. And then as a person who has the bigger, broader view, I cannot see, but I can guess and fear. Now, God wouldn't say I can guess and fear, but we, the people who are in the likeness of God compared to this mouse, we transfer that fear of the mouse to our own kinds of fears, and we don't know what's going on above us. But in some ways, I think the poem is saying, in some ways, he's got the whole world in his hands, even when bad things happen to good people.
Again, I think as we look back on it, can see in the past, and this is, I think, faith at work within us, is even when things have gone bad, God's hand has got us through them. And that's what gives us hope for the future as well, even though the future is unknown.
I often have the easiest things to look up, I think, in the Bible are passages from the wisdom literature, from either Proverbs or Ecclesiastes and so on. And Proverbs are so memorable, but there's a little passage from Proverbs 19 that says, many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it's the purpose of the Lord that will stand. That's almost poetic, actually. And so we Christians come with faith that God's in charge, even when our whole apple cart has been upset.
Yeah, we also hear in Romans that the Lord works for good in the lives of all those who love him, even in the midst of the troubles and trials and tribulations.
Well, that the eternal presence and God's presence there, he doesn't promise to make everything be wonderful for us, but it's that I'm with you in the midst of it all. I'm walking with you, and he walked the walk and talked the talk. When I was in college, I had a wonderful course in Psalms, Proverbs, and wisdom literature, and you quickly learn that Proverbs is sort of the glass half full, and Ecclesiastes is the glass half empty. So I've got a parallel to the Proverbs passage here with Ecclesiastes 3. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's put eternity into a man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. In some ways, Ecclesiastes is saying God's ways can be hidden from us. You pastors hear and talk about that a lot, I think, when you're both preaching and talking to people in your consultations, right?
Yeah. And again, Luther would probably refer to that as the masks of God. God is often hidden behind things that we don't expect. Water, bread, wine, the word, the preacher. Those are not where you would expect to find God. And Luther, again, in his discussion of affliction or Anfechtung, God can use these difficulties to actually strengthen our faith, draw us closer to him.
Luther is, gosh, there's hardly a part of the Bible Luther didn't preach on, but he was a big user, believer, and relier on the Psalms. And there's a great one toward the very end of the book of Psalms that says, Psalm 146, I believe, says, put not your trust in princes, in a son of man, in whom there is no salvation. When his breath departs, he returns to the earth. On that very day, his plans perish. And then the flip side, blessed is he whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord, his God, who made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, who keeps faith forever. So he basically, he's the God of all the little tiny, all of us are mice with our little hordes of things in this world. But don't put your trust in princes, though you do have to obey them. Luther benefited, however, from his prince, but that's another story.
And we as human beings, we like to think we are in control of our own destiny, but really, we are not. And all those things we often put our hopes in fail us and let us down in the end.
Well, the only thing for biblical references further, it's almost impossible to skip Matthew 6, the Sermon on the Mount. several different ways. It says, do not lay up treasures on earth for yourself, but lay up treasures in heaven. Now, that's not pie in the sky kind of stuff, but go ahead and work in the world, but your real treasure. We enter it the same way as we leave it, naked, basically. And so lay up your treasure in heaven. You get to know the master of the universe himself. Robert Burns, by the way, was a man of faith. And I have a little picture that I'm going to try to paint about this man who was able to envision in such a wonderful way the life of a little mouse whose house was all upset. Burns himself's life was short. He was a hardworking farmer, and his heart apparently was weakened either through infection or bacterial infection. Modern day, we look backwards and kind of diagnose that. But when he was in his late 30s, he was in Ayrshire, and he was a bit fed up with his physicians, and he took matters in his own hands, and he said, I'm going to go to the sea, and I'm going to basically take the cure like people often did, trying to bathe. And there was a well nearby, just a few miles from the ocean or from where he had lived in Alloway. And he went to this well that had mineral water, iron and minerals that were supposed to be good for you. And then he was supposed to get fresh air and so on. But he was there, and nearby was the parish of a town called Ruthwell. And if anyone is listening from Scotland, you will know of the Ruthwell Cross. It's a huge, probably, 17, 18 feet high, carved cross from Saxon period that was in the parish yard, and was taken down in pieces and hidden during the dissolution of the monastery time, when everybody was breaking all the icons and so on. But this had been a carved cross from the 700s, the same time we talked about a couple weeks ago about Cadman, the Saxon cowherd, who miraculously spoke poetry overnight. About the same time, Cadman was at Whitby. Whitby and those events were happening about the same time of this carved cross. The carved cross was in the churchyard at Ruthwell, and 3 days or four before he died, Robert Burns went and visited the Ruthwell manse and spoke with the pastor, the minister there. And there's a wonderful story of how he was visiting with the pastor's wife and his daughter, maybe waiting for some tea to be served. And Burns is sitting in a chair, and the picture, the artwork that draws this scene that I'm looking at right now, so I'll try to paint the picture for you. Burns is sitting in a chair looking very much like an ill, pale man, but with Burns's great big brown eyes and his hair kind of combed over his forehead. And his hands are sort of loosely on the chair arm, and his feet flat on the carpet. And he's looking at the window, and the window is shining light on his face. But the daughter gets up, and she wants to shut the sun out of his eyes. And he raises his hand, and he holds his hand up and says, no, 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 leave the sun. He knew he was dying. And he said, leave the sun, because that sunlight has na lang to shine for me. It doesn't have long to shine for me, so leave it be. And the picture was of a man of faith who knew he was ready to meet his maker, but he wanted to feel the sunshine of this earth as long as he could and enjoy the last little bits that he had written. Oh, dozens and dozens and dozens of poems about the beauty of nature and about its people, and with great sense of humor and so on. But that wonderful picture and the quote from Robert Burns toward the end of his life gives us a glimpse of a person of faith who is a trustworthy poetic guide, I believe.
Well, Dr. Bachman, you've also mentioned that you wanted to look at a second poem by Burns, To a Louse. Can you tell us a little bit about that one, please?
I would. Most of the time, school books will print To a Mouse and To a Louse on side-by-side pages, because they rhyme and so on. But you have to explain, especially to children, what is a louse? We know that something's lousy, but we don't really take it back. We don't assume that it's connected to lice, which are the kinds of lice that can get into your hair and other parts of your body and make you itch. And it's really, you know, it's a kind of a gross thing. But so why would Robert Burns write a poem to a louse? And it usually makes children chuckle. And if children can chuckle about poetry, I'm happy, because then they're actually going to read it. So again, for the listeners, if you are from Scotland, I'm not going to do it justice in the brogue that is appropriate to Robert Burns. But mostly I'm going to summarize it, but just read the very crux of the poem and its purpose. But I hope you've had a chance to be familiar with this particular poem. It takes place in church. The setting is church. And what Burns is so good at as a lyric poet, through the forms and with rhymes and rhythms and so on, he still makes you see and feel what it's like to sit in a pew in the middle of church. This poor pastor is probably working very hard up there to give his sermon, and he's trying to make it meaningful. And just like most of us have experienced, our minds wander, and Burns's mind is wandering, because right in front of him is a beautiful young woman with a bonnet, and she's got ribbons and so on. And no doubt he's imagining something about this woman. But then he notices a louse, a little individual licey thing, climbing up and down on her ribbon and on strands of her hair. And you're immediately taken into the scene in this church of that louse and him watching it go up and down the ribbon, up and down on her neck hair. And the poem is all about his thoughts about that. So are you familiar with this one, John?
No, I must confess, I don't know this one.
Have you ever sat in the pew, or are you always preaching?
No, once in a while I sit in the pew. And unfortunately, the mind does wander once in a while.
It does. And sometimes it's the pastor's fault, because he gives you such a good idea to think about. I often tell our pastor here, Pastor Krieger, that, oh, that was such a good idea. I thought about it for 5 minutes and I missed the next 5 minutes of your sermon. But all of us, I think, Ken, you are in this poem like a telescope, just taken, or microscope, I guess it is, taken down. So you see the ribbons and you see this beautiful woman sitting there, and the louse is toying with him. He's going up and down and poking his head out and so on. Let me see if I can find the first little bit here. It says, "Aha, where are you going, you crawlin' fairly? Your impudence protects you surely. I cannot say, but a little bit rarely, over gauze and lace, though I fear you dine but sparely on such a place." So he's crawling over the gauze and lace of the woman's bonnet, or her collar or something like that. And he's thinking, well, why would you be there? That's kind of not a very rich place to dine. And so he describes the louse as ugly and a creeping wonder, detest and shunned by saint and sinner. How dare you set your feet upon her, such a fine lady? Go somewhere else and seek your dinner on some poor body. So he's offended that this gross little buggy thing is on the gal he was kind of having a hankering for. So you have a numbers of his thoughts, and I'll leave it to the readers to go through all of them. But the most famous part in this particular poem is really a bit of faith, but also a wish, a prayer. And here's the original with a little bit of changes in the Burns original, the sort of punchline or thesis statement of the poem. "Oh, would some power the gifty gie us to see ourselves as ithers see us. It would from many a blunder free us and foolish notion. What airs in dress and gait would leave us, and even devotion." So basically, if God would let us see ourselves the way other people see us, we might change our ways. We might not stumble into dumb things that we thought we were going to get away with. But if we saw how others see us, and sometimes don't really want to know what other people think of me, because then I might have to change, or it might be embarrassing.
Yeah, when we read the scriptures, I think that's what offends people the most, is that the scriptures say, hey, you are by nature sinful. You are in rebellion against God. And we like to think of ourselves as actually pretty nice people, but the scriptures tell us that all have gone astray. And that's a message that we don't like to hear.
Absolutely. I've got one that actually, I'm thinking about the Psalms again, which is also one of the things the Anglo-Saxon people really enjoyed the Psalms, and they made special little boxes to put their small little Psalm books that they had, which of course would have been expensive because everything was copied by hand in those days. Of course, Robert Burns was like 1,000 years later than these Anglo-Saxons, but still here. Psalm 19, it's an address about God's power over us and our inabilities. But anyway, who can discern his errors? Declare me innocent from hidden faults. So we know we have them. We know we have hidden faults, but we can't see them. And that's what Burns has captured with this little funny poem about the little buggy louse. One more, Psalm 69 says, O God, you know my folly. The wrongs I have done are not hidden from you. So whether or not we intend to do evil, we have hidden faults. We don't see ourselves as others see us.
And Jesus had a lot to say about that too, didn't he?
Of course. We all love the time when Jesus is informing all the tax collectors and money changers in the temple, and he gets righteously indignant at those. Those are great passages where he makes it perfectly clear what we ought to be thinking about the misbehavior of certain people in the scriptures, of course. Well, I think the power of Burns' poems come from two things. Either one of these, the to a mouse or to a louse, they come from his using of the traditional lilt of what is now called the Burns stanza. And the Burns stanza goes back to many generations, even before Robert Burns. But he focused his thoughts and put it into this familiar kind of stanza that has the longer lines and then the shorter lines. So when you hear, oh, would some power the gift to gie us, that's a long line, here's another long line, to see ourselves as others see us, it would from many a blunder free us. But then there's the short line, like a little exclamation mark, and foolish notion. And then a long line comes again, what airs in dress and gait would leave us, and even devotion. And that last one is kind of a dig at super pious Christians who are super proud of how they go to church. And so we have to watch it. Even when we do the good things like go to church, we can be all messed up in what is our purpose. I'm here to show off my bonnet. I'm here to make the women look at me because I'm Mr. Studley. And so what Burns manages to do in disciplining his thoughts into these kinds of lines and rhyme schemes, that he manages to paint a picture of himself, makes fun of himself being the one who's viewing, but he also makes fun of us or allows us to see our faults. And that seems to me a worthy thing to do when we recite the Lord's Prayer and the commandments. We are examining ourselves and trying to say, Lord, show me where I'm going astray, where I need to improve and put my faith in you.
And I think Jesus does the same thing when he talks about how you see the speck in other people's eyes, but you miss the big plank sticking out of your own eye.
Absolutely.
He in jest and in humor talks about how we're good at picking out everybody else's little foibles and faults, but the one that we miss is the one that should be hitting us over the head like a 2x4, and that's our own.
Absolutely. The moat in our own eye, and then everybody has to wonder, what's a moat? It sounds like something that goes around a castle, but it means the annoying little piece of dirt that's in your eye.
Dr. Bachman, unfortunately, we've run out of time again this week, but we thank you for your insights in helping us to look at literature, whether it's Christian or secular, and reading it through the eyes of faith. We'll carry on our conversation next week, and we invite our listeners to join us as we look at some short lyrical poems from England, Ireland, and America. So we'll talk to you next week, Dr. Bachman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.